So, hey, Randy, what's going on?
Welcome, Jim. It's good to hear your voice.
Welcome. Okay, now I'm a little bit worried. What did you want to talk about today, Randy?
This is actually a subject of great interest of mine, especially currently. We're going to talk about the quantum vacuum.
Okay.
And, you know, there's this huge debate, or rather, I should say, there's two perspectives on the nature of the quantum vacuum that are diametrically opposed, and this seems to be very controversial right now. I'm kind of bewildered by it, and I'm hoping that we can maybe start to get a handle on it, because it's very important to the whole bedrock of physics, I think, the nature of the vacuum itself, you know, and we're going to talk about vacuum fluctuations and zero-point energy and all that kind of thing. This is kind of an arduous subject to deal with, because it seems like lately, these interpretations of the Casimir effect are shifting in favor of a van der Waals interaction effect, whereas all of my favorite theoretical physicists, Richard Feynman, Stephen Hawking, Leonard Susskind, Steven Weinberg, Frank Wilczek, and even recently we talked about Dragan Hajdukovic's work, the CERN theoretical physicist, all of these people that I love and admire, they all talk about vacuum fluctuations as a physical phenomenon. That it's real, and that the microcosm is this broiling sea of energy. And that's really everything that I've read about it was always in those terms. But this new work on the Casimir effect seems to challenge that very directly and, in some cases, very convincingly. So let's get into it.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about this. So where did you want to start with talking about this?
I'd like to start with the Casimir effect and the quantum vacuum by Jaffe, the 2005 paper that we talked about. He's an MIT physicist. He seems very reputable, and I liked his paper. It's concise and thoughtful. It doesn't seem to really answer the question, which is kind of frustrating. And he does limit his focus to the Casimir effect, but the only experimental argument made in favor of the physical nature of vacuum fluctuations is the Casimir effect. Didn't realize that there was really, apparently, no other compelling argument that proves their existence. So by taking this on and showing that it can be modeled without any vacuum fluctuations and perhaps maybe more fundamental to argue that it's not vacuum fluctuations doing it, it kind of throws a real wrench into the works.
Do you think you could remind everybody what the Casimir effect is?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is the experiment where you have two metal conductive plates that are facing each other parallel, and when you put them very, very close together, they have an attractive force between them. They will tend to collapse together. And at very, very small distances, the force becomes significant. And there's even some more exotic experiments where you can, I believe these are just theoretical at this point, but maybe one day we'll see some experimental proof of this. I think you can create Casimir levitation, where you have like a sphere over a certain concave shape, and then it can levitate. Well, the Casimir effect has the ability to create repulsive forces, which I guess are important for what they're doing with micromechanical devices. So it can go either way. It can either attract plates together when you've got a smooth flat surface, but with different topologies, it can also repel. And it's this purely quantum effect. It has always, everything that I've ever read about the Casimir effect, always talked about this as proof that there are vacuum fluctuations in the electromagnetic spectrum, and that when you put the plates close together, that you're excluding certain frequencies of electromagnetic vacuum fluctuations from between them, and the energy difference between the outside and the inside causes them to collapse together. But we talked, I think in one of our episodes in the past, we talked about how there was an alternative way of looking at this mechanism that had nothing to do with vacuum fluctuations. And so we decided to follow up on that. And so we're going to talk a little bit more about that now and see if we can hopefully come to some kind of consensus or maybe a deeper understanding of the problem.
Yeah, so the last time we talked about a paper called A Materials Perspective on the Casimir Effect. Possibly it also was talked about the van der Waals forces as well. So it definitely talked about the van der Waals forces, and it talked about them as originating from sort of the same place. That was a large review paper that we slogged through, so it didn't have a point of view so much as either of these papers that we're going to talk about today, which are actually very pointed, the real arguments, whereas the other one was a talk about not only the theory, but also some of the experimental details, I think. So that was a much more in-depth paper. And I think it has a lot to say about this, but this particular topic gets a little bit lost in the details of, you know, a giant review paper with three or four lines of citations in between every sentence.
I was just going to mention that one of the motivations recently for looking at the vacuum fluctuations and whether they're real or not is this whole issue of the cosmological constant and dark energy. A lot of astrophysicists I see talk about how there could be a relationship between the dark energy and vacuum fluctuations, and all of the astrophysicists that I've read actually seem to model the cosmological constant, the dark energy factor, as a universal field of energy in the empty vacuum. They use general relativity to describe this positive acceleration gravitationally.
Yeah, so that's basically what the cosmological constant is it's a background scalar field. It's not a gravitational field, but it acts more like a mass. That's a bunch of stuff out there that either makes the world attractive or repulsive or something like that. And so if you have some sort of positive cosmological constant, you expect to have some sort of background energy. The only issue with that is the predictions about how much the vacuum is fluctuating, how much energy there is out there based on vacuum fluctuations. There should be much, much more energy than what we see. There should be a much, much larger cosmological constant than what we see.
Right. They call that one the vacuum catastrophe.
Oh, no.
Because the prediction from quantum mechanics predicts up to 120 orders of magnitude more energy in every cubic centimeter than we're seeing with dark energy in the cosmological constant. So that's definitely a catastrophe.
Something's not matching up somewhere. That might have some sort of issue somewhere. It might not. We can talk about that a little bit later when we talk about this second paper. But that is an indication of something, right? If there is that much energy wandering around, then it should somehow be gravitating, because that's what energy does.
Yeah, but I wanted to ask you about that. But if you have that same density of energy everywhere uniformly in space, how would you measure that there's a gravitational field there? Like, wouldn't it be flat?
Did you do that on purpose? Was that a rim shot?
That was me. That was me hitting my electronic vaporizer and sending it across the room.
Well, that's going to be one of Nikolic's points later on, is that if you have a uniform background, you shouldn't be able to notice it at all. It should not produce any forces because it's uniform. But on the other hand, that's not true in general relativity, right? In general relativity, it's this energy, the stress energy tensor, that's causing the deformation. In that nonlinear theory, that's not really the case. It's just when it gets linearized later on, it is the case. But if you have some huge quantum vacuum out there with lots of fluctuations, then you should have those. You should have that energy wandering around, and it should be deforming space somehow. Of course, this just could be how everything's modeled, but according to quantum theory, the reason why you have vacuum fluctuations is because you should have some sort of ground state energy that's greater than zero. So when you do your calculations, for the same reason we were talking about, there should be no difference, there should be no forces if you've got no difference in energy. You can sort of just pretend that this ground state level is zero, even though you've got the rest of that stuff going on. Even though you have these oscillations going on in the background, those oscillations don't affect anything because they're uniform. And technically, there's an infinite amount of energy wandering around in those oscillations, but because they shouldn't have any physical realization, you can renormalize to zero. Anyways, that's just what's supposed to be going on because of this. That may just be something in some sort of interpretation of the mathematics that we're getting wrong.
What might be an interpretation that we're getting wrong?
That there is a non-zero energy, that the ground state is something other than a zero energy state. But probably not. I think as far as the mathematics is concerned, it seems very, very clear how to interpret it.
But can't you ascribe that uncertainty factor to the fields of matter instead of ascribing them to an external force acting from the vacuum?
I don't understand.
For example, when we're looking at the Casimir effect, they can predict the magnitude of the force by ascribing the Casimir force to the fields of the matter in the plates and the photons they're exchanging, and they reproduce that effect. I'm guessing there's basically kind of a noise in the fields themselves of the matter, and it seems like that's an alternative way of getting to the same result as modeling it as a vacuum energy that's all through space.
I think the whole idea with that noise is that it's sort of a universal white noise. So if you were to take a very, very small area, you might see the fluctuations themselves. But if you look at a large enough area, if you're looking at that cubic centimeter, that's so large that all this energy from the fluctuations averages out. And so it's basically a uniform bit of energy that you have there.
The trick seems to be, though, that you can't observe the existence of those fluctuations without matter. And so, yeah, it becomes kind of a philosophical conundrum. Like, how do you prove that it's there without using something that gives you another avenue to explain it entirely?
Now you're actually moving into this Jaffe paper. Well, yeah, I mean, that could be an issue, right? I mean, you have to interact with something to actually see anything. You might be able to do something where you can somehow characterize the fluctuations in your regular object somewhere away from where your particular experiment is going on, and you look at the differences between how that object interacts in the situation, in the experiment, and in the control. And possibly that could give you something to look at as a difference.
Well, that raises a question. Is, since we can't eliminate the noise of quantum mechanics from any system, we can't really do a control to see if the vacuum fluctuations are there or not. But what did occur to me was that if we ascribe the Casimir force to the interaction between the matter of the plates instead of the vacuum between the plates, then doesn't that suggest that the Casimir effect should be in some way temperature dependent? Because if we had more photons interacting between the plates, shouldn't that change the magnitude of the force?
I would generally assume that it would have some sort of temperature dependence. And in fact, I think at least one of these papers was saying that it had something to do with the relative permittivity with the dielectric constant. And if that's the case, then yeah, it should have the same temperature dependence as the dielectric constant.
That's interesting. Yeah, the second paper gets into that in some detail. He does a really detailed derivation of his toy model to explain the mechanism. Okay, I'll have to do some more looking into that. It'd be nice if we knew of some way to alter the magnitude of the vacuum fluctuations in theory themselves so that we could set up a condition where we changed the magnitude of the vacuum fluctuations and compared between, you know, two different experiments to see if they're real, you know? But that's another way of going about it with the matter itself, right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that if you were to find a way to change the magnitude of the vacuum fluctuations, would they still be the vacuum fluctuations?
That's right. Maybe they'd become real, because if I understand it correctly, the vacuum fluctuations are like half the energy of the real particle. Is that correct?
Half the energy of the real particle?
Yeah, like if you have the quantum field for a photon.
That I don't know. You're saying that the energy of one of these, the virtual photons in the field, is half the energy of what a real photon, a photon that actually interacted with something, is. And no, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, they're also described as pairs, which I find confusing. But this paper doesn't get too much into that. It talks more about...
Well, I mean, it certainly has this expansion in terms of these pairs, right? It has this diagrammatic expansion of the Casimir force. I think the idea behind that is this energy is supposed to be some sort of closed loop. You know, you have this stuff coming into and going out of existence, is how I understand it, right? So basically, if your Feynman diagram basically is a big circle, it's a simple closed curve where you get some energy, get some photons, and then you don't have any anymore.
Yeah, but when I see explanations of things like Hawking radiation, they always create these diagrams where like a virtual pair of photons appears out of nothing and then creates a circle and then self-annihilates on the other side. Those two diagrams look a little differently. I guess the Feynman diagrams are more technically accurate.
No, those are Feynman diagrams, I think, that you're talking about.
Oh, are they?
The ones they're drawing here look a lot like Excel drawings. Or the ones they're drawing here seem to be simplified compared to a lot of other techniques. But, you know, they're still pretty much the same thing. They show, like, you might look at something where you see an electron going forward and then, you know, you get a splitting and then it comes back and the electron comes back together and the electron comes out. Now, you can draw these in slightly more and slightly less complicated ways with more angles and more curves or whatever, so that they look more or less complicated or professional or something like that. But they all really mean the same thing. You read them all pretty much the same way, so you can just read those things. But at some level, you need to have these Feynman diagrams for these, because, you know, this Casimir force comes about because it's a relativistic effect. So if it's a quantum relativistic effect, you have to use quantum electrodynamics, and then you end up with having to draw Feynman diagrams at some point.
Okay. But Feynman himself seemed to think that the vacuum fluctuations were a real property of space.
A lot of people do. I mean, as much as this first paper, at least, is arguing that you can't use the Casimir effect as an experimental proof that there are vacuum fluctuations, he seems very, very open about the fact that a whole lot of people, a whole lot of very smart people, not only believe that there are vacuum fluctuations, but that the Casimir effect is showing that there is just such a fluctuation. It's not a crazy thing to say. You can I think there's a reason why you have these guys producing this kind of paper to try to show that the Casimir effect is not generated from some sort of quantum vacuum rather than the other way around. And it's because so many people in their community, I'm not sure who everybody is, but so many people in at least one community in physics, and there are different communities in physics, believe in these vacuum fluctuations. Obviously, the materials guys have a perspective, and the high energy physics guys have a perspective, and those are two different perspectives. But as you can tell just by reading that materials paper previously, that guy didn't give a damn about what the vacuum fluctuations were at all. He just went in and said, this is the sort of work that we do, and this is how we interpret it, and here are a bunch of graphs. He didn't spend any time wandering around trying to tell people that they were doing something fundamentally mistaken, and they had some really nasty problems with physics, like Nikolic does. So it's only in this one context that there's a problem. Are you there, Randy?
Oh, I lost you for a minute there, Jim. So I don't know if you finished that sentence you were talking about. Nikolovich? Nikolic? If you can pronounce that guy's first name, I will give you, you know, a free coffee next time I see you. Hrvoje. How do you pronounce that, Jim?
Rolway.
Okay.
But, you know, I don't want to meet him in a dark alley now. I'm sure I've mispronounced both of his names at least once.
Well, he's adamant. He just comes right out. Well, we'll get into that later, but he comes right out and he says, zero-point energy is known to be unphysical. Who said that?
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. I think the way he's saying that is a little bit different than the way you're interpreting it, because he has a definite viewpoint and somehow comes out in his technical writing, which is talent. Is there anything that we think we should talk about as far as the Casimir effect in Chaffee?
He doesn't get into the kind of detail that the next paper gets into, but he does make the same point. And the point is that the Casimir force is simply a relativistic, retarded van der Waals force between metal plates. And the next paper gets into the exact details of that, which was good, but it was very rigorous, I think, the way that he looked at it.
Yeah, this particular paper, I think, gives a little more detail about the rationale why you'd want to look at this, because he starts talking about what happens in real experiments. Real experiments don't look like the thing that Casimir wrote, the thing that Casimir was looking at, theoretically, because Casimir was looking at perfect conductors.
Which just so happened to drop out all the important stuff that you needed to know its mechanism, apparently.
Yeah, and according to these guys, it does that, but that creates a bit of a problem for the experimenters because they don't have those perfect conductors wandering around. So when they're doing this, they have to find some way to actually describe the experiments and make predictions about the experiments that they're doing.
Could you do these experiments with superconductive ceramics?
Probably not. It might be very difficult because you'd be simultaneously trying to have a vacuum and to cool these things down to a extremely low temperature.
Might be good for space, though, huh?
Maybe you could do it in space. So let's write up that proposal and see if we can become astronauts.
I don't think we have to go. Can't we just tell somebody to throw the switch?
Well, then what fun is it?
To knowing the results, that's good enough for me. I don't want to go up in any of these crazy rockets. I'm waiting for like some kind of anti-gravity propulsion because, you know, the idea of riding on top of a bomb until you're out of the Earth's atmosphere is just too hair-raising for me.
Come on. If Elon Musk has anything to do with it, I'm sure it has a really good suspension.
I'll go up after he goes up.
Okay. All right. So, yeah. There has to be something to do with a real material in there to figure out, you know, why the results that you get aren't exactly the same as the predictions. And somehow this ended up getting to something about the fine structure constant. You know, the Casimir force in the real world, or the Casimir force when he uses the Drude model for metals, which is a very simple model for metals, but it's also a classical or a semi-classical model for metals. So when he uses that, he gets a similar equation with the same dependencies and says that, you know, this only works in a particular limit, which is usually satisfied, or probably is always satisfied. So he says that for a particular sort of setup with a 500 nanometer spacing, for example, with copper, get a prediction that the fine structure constant should be greater than 10 to the minus 5. It's like 10 to the minus 2. It's 1 over 137. So that gives you three orders of magnitude, but that also gives you some idea about what you can do to improve things. You know, if you can decrease that spacing, you can get closer to that alpha limit, and you should be able to see the derivations, and you should actually be able to see whether or not this Drude model is more viable than the original Casimir calculus.
Oh, I see. I didn't realize that they came up with different results. Somehow I must have skipped over that part. I thought they were just expressing the same math in different terms, but you're saying that they're actually different predictions.
Well, yeah. According to this, there is a slightly different prediction here. He's saying that...
That's exciting.
Yeah. So the standard Casimir result is the alpha goes to infinity limit. Or another way of saying that is the fine structure constant is much larger than this quantity that he has there, which is not really too complicated. It goes like 1 over the number density of charge carriers in the metal times the spacing between the plates squared, the square of the spacing between the plates. Everything else is sort of a universal constant or a number of some kind. That means that you can probably test this out. You can say, okay, is this right? And it looks like you only need 3 orders of magnitude, and you've got at least 2 different things to play with. So if you could get down to a 5-nanometer spacing, which might be iffy, I'm not sure, you would definitely be out of the situation that he's talking about. If you change the material a little bit, you might be able to go down to 50 nanometers and be able to test it. Obviously, he doesn't talk about testing it. And I'm remembering this now when I skimmed through the old paper that we talked about previously. I didn't look to see what was going on, how that correlated to this particular argument. But as we'll talk about in a second, how well it conforms to this particular argument might not be germane. But definitely, if there's a huge change as the spacing gets smaller, and that change can be ruled out of some problem with the experiment, then we have something that's going to say there's something wrong with the typical Casimir result and you need to look at certain corrections. But I think they're already looking at certain corrections, so that does tell you something.
Yeah, this is a 2005 paper, so it's been 12 years. So hopefully maybe we can find another paper sometime that gets to the theoretical heart of this and can compare the experimental results they've had recently with the theoretical foundations, and maybe we can discern between which of these models is more powerful.
Possibly, yeah.
So is the Drude model the one that talked about plasma frequency and skin depth and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think he's looking at the plasma frequency and the skin depth in the Drude model. The Drude model itself is just a very simple model about how electrons react in a metal to electric fields. Or to a potential, same thing.
And the copper or whatever conductor has to have a dipole electrical moment, right, in order to have the van der Waals force interactions?
Well, I think there are fluctuations in the electric dipoles of the atoms, but I think copper generally does. Everything's a dielectric material. Everything has some sort of dipole moment, at least in the presence of an electric field. There are lots of little fields going on, which means you have something oscillating and randomly moving around all the time. You're going to have some sort of oscillating dipole moment, whether or not the net dipole moment is zero.
Is that where the photons in the polarity photons come in the next paper? Is the photons induce a change in the dipole moment?
Something like that. I actually think that was the most insightful thing in the two papers was the polariton. Although, you know, that has to do with some of these fundamental problems that Nikolich is discussing. If we want to move on to that paper, I think it's probably about time to move there anyway.
Well, I'd like to go over the conclusion briefly because he left it very ambivalently, and I found it really unsatisfying and frustrating because on one hand, it does seem like he made a really convincing argument that you can calculate the Casimir force without any vacuum fluctuations. And, you know, I'm tentatively ready to accept that because it looks good. But then he also says that there's still good reason to be skeptical of attempts to avoid the standard formulation of quantum field theory and the zero-point energies that it brings with it. But I think one of the things that he cites is quantum chromodynamics, that you can't use an S-matrix model to create an explanation for that. And there's also symmetry breaking, which seems to require zero-point fluctuations. And apparently nobody has succeeded in formulating QED yet, although I think it was Schwinger that tried without vacuum fluctuations. He doesn't seem to think that we can eliminate them from QED entirely, which is kind of confounding.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know that you should think about it that way. Again, we'll talk about this when we're talking about the next paper. I don't think you can really get rid of the vacuum fluctuations. I mean, there's a guy who wrote an entire book as an introduction to QED through the device of the vacuum fluctuation.
Right, but they've succeeded in doing it the other way, that you could explain QED in terms of vacuum fluctuations. So it's a very powerful model, and darn it, you know, is it real?
Probably there should be something like this. I mean, you might need a stronger idea about what the vacuum fluctuations really are, what the vacuum really is. That's another series of shows right there. And as far as I can tell by reading it, even if we get through a bunch of shows on that, we're still not going to understand it because other people don't.
Well, because the really frustrating thing that we're left here with is here he's explained the Casimir force without vacuum fluctuations in a really convincing and kind of mechanistic causal way. They can't both be real.
Well, I think what he's saying is that this paper, at least what he originally said he wanted to conclude this from this paper, is the standard calculation of the Casimir force from the vacuum energy is illegitimate. But that does not necessarily mean that there is no vacuum energy.
But if there were vacuum energy, it should yield something like the Casimir effect to begin with. So if he's modeling it without those, then how can you have both being true?
His idea was to show that Casimir force is not
proof of 0-point energies.
That's right. You know, he's saying that this model, this old model for the Casimir effect is illegitimate, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything about the vacuum fluctuations. It's just, you know, you've done something wrong in your derivation somewhere. A third paper by Nikolic tries to go into that and show where it goes wrong. And that's really mathematical. And Nikolic is already mathematical in this one, but the reason why I wanted to look at this paper, not the other one, which was proof of the Casimir force does not originate from vacuum energy, is 0-point energy physical one I wanted to look at instead, is because it's got more of a positive argument to it. It's got more of something to say rather than just trying to knock something down by saying you can't take that derivative for technical reasons.
Okay.
But at least one of the authors we're talking about today is saying that for technical reasons, you can't actually take a derivative that you've been taking. I don't really like the argument. It may be right, it may be wrong, but I don't really like the argument. It doesn't really tell me much of anything.
Well, I think where it leaves you is, it's like, okay, Mr. Smarty Pants, if you think that that's the problem, then why don't you go ahead and formulate QED without vacuum fluctuations and put an end to this debate, right?
There's always that. You know, we can always write Mr. Smarty Pants a letter.
We'll open it that way. He'll be really appreciative.
Another thing may well be simply that Jaffe's a physicist, right? And he's been doing this stuff a long time, and he's couching things a little bit, just saying, you know, hey, you know, I've said one thing here, but that's not the end-all be-all about the rest of the thing. There's a limited scope to what you can conclude from this paper.
Well, I did a little looking on the author of the next paper, is your point energy physical, a toy model for Casimir-like effect by Nikolic. And he's a Croatian theoretical physicist. He got his PhD in 2001. He's no spring chicken. You know, he's been working on physics for quite a while. Maybe it's because he's in Croatia, but I couldn't find a whole lot about him.
Well, I mean, this paper and the other one, I don't remember what they were. I did look them up, and they were published in reputable journals.
Right, so he's the real deal.
That doesn't mean he's right, but it does mean that what he's doing is not crazy, at least to first order. So is there anything you'd like to talk about with this initially?
About the second paper?
Yes.
I think we should just jump right in. I mean, he starts off with 0-point energy is generally known to be unphysical. You said that he meant something different about that. That seemed really clear to me.
I think what he was saying there is the same thing that we were saying at the beginning of the podcast, which is that the 0-point energy, since it's sort of a uniform background, doesn't create effects that you can see. That's what I think he was trying to say when he said it's unphysical. You know, when he first said unphysical, I was saying, okay, well, this is a pretty strong statement. And he said a couple of things not very long after that, like in the next sentence or a sentence or two later, that basically said that all he's really saying is that there's no delta E from it, so there's no F, right? There's no change in the energy, so there's no force from that 0-point energy.
When I hear the word unphysical, I think something else than that.
Me too. Me too. So when he first said that, I was thinking he was going to make a really, really strong argument. But this is a little bit less than what you'd normally think of when you first hear those words.
One of the things I wanted to mention was that I saw a PhD thesis paper called Acoustic Casimir Effect from the Naval Postgraduate School. And he'd done this wonderful treatment on creating an analog for the Casimir effect using broadband noise in an experimental chamber with a couple of plates. I thought that was fascinating. In that case, I mean, the energy is definitely physical, and you could probably subtract it out mathematically, but that doesn't make it any less real. So anyway, then he gets into his toy model, and he describes a toy model with 3 degrees of freedom. He talks about the electromagnetic field, degree of freedom, the polarization field within the plate material, degree of freedom, and the spatial separation, degree of freedom. Now, apparently in quantum mechanics, there's an infinite number of degrees of freedom, and he's just trying to create a really simple tool to show us a mechanism, right?
Yeah, those are sort of the minimal parameters, right? You need electromagnetic, microscopic charge density, and the distance between the plates. And these all have to be dynamic parameters. So one of the things that Nikolic is discussing is that when you're making your derivations, your sort of classic derivation of the Casimir effect, you use sort of a static separation between the plates. And when you do that, you just sort of stick them there and you do your little calculation about the electromagnetic modes. And then you say, okay, inside only these electromagnetic modes are okay. Outside, all of them are okay. So you have this sort of pressure difference. You end up with something like a pressure because of the change in the energy, and the plates get pushed together. But he says that's not good enough. Since you've modeled that Y is static, you can't then go in and do what you'd normally do with an energy. One of the things you'd normally do with a sort of potential energy between two plates is you take the derivative of that potential energy, multiply it by minus one, and that would give you the force between the plates. But he's saying that because you didn't model that static variable, that static separation as a dynamical variable, you can't really get anything out of. So he wants to add in that Y, or that distance between the plates, that separation between the plates as a dynamical variable. So that's that third thing in there. And he models them very simply. So he models each one of these things as a single parameter, basically an X, a Y, and a Z. I guess he had an X1, X2, and a G, right? The X1, this number X1, was supposed to model the entire electromagnetic field. This number X2 is supposed to be the pure matter field, and G is the charge field interaction term. And with those three things and a bunch of math, you can get something like a Casimir effect. And that's what he does. Most of this paper, the beginning is highly philosophical. The ending has some physical suggestions. And in the middle, there's a lot of math. And that's what the math is playing with.
Yeah, it was a really rigorous and thorough derivation. So you can see all of his reasoning and how he gets to his final equations. That was really good. So that people can really analyze this and take a look at it and think about it. And I'm going to have to spend more time with it because it is really detailed and it's really hard to go through like 15 pages of math, you know, keep your mind sharp. But one of the things that he comes to at the end, that after he shows that he's done this, is he says the Casimir force is impossible in a photon vacuum. What does he mean by this?
The way I interpreted that was, so if you look at the beginning of the paper, he has a long philosophical discussion about what it means to be a vacuum. And after what it means to be a vacuum, it goes on from there with three or four different things. Is the Casimir effect a vacuum state? Well, he's got two different ideas about what a vacuum state could be. He has something that he'd consider to be a true vacuum, which would be that photon vacuum. It's a vacuum where the elementary excitations are photons or virtual photons or whatever they are. They're basically photons. And then a sort of fake vacuum would have some matter in it. Like in, say, the Casimir effect, you have two metal plates. Those two metal plates make whatever your situation is not a vacuum. And on top of that, your elementary excitations are no longer photons. They're a little bit of photon, or probably a lot of photon, and a little bit of wiggling in the matter itself.
Those excitons are phonons, I guess those would be, huh?
These are the polaritons.
Right, that's how he gets to the polaritons.
Yeah, so a polariton should be a sort of polarization fluctuation, a plus a little bit of an electromagnetic interaction. It's a little bit electron, a little bit photon.
So that's why he's saying that you can't have a Casimir force without the photons, is that you won't have any polaritons in the material to interact?
Yeah, if it's a purely photonic excitation, he's saying, then you're not getting any excitations in the material. If you don't have any excitations in the material, you don't have anything that's actually going to pull the two plates together. So instead, what he's saying is that the elementary excitations between these two plates are actually wave functions that extend through that vacuum and a little bit into each one of those plates, and includes some of the electrons, some of the electron states in those other two areas, some of the polarization states. And so when you excite these quasi-particles, then you're going to get your Casimir force.
It would be interesting if there was some kind of way to manipulate that physically. Like if there was some way you could get a certain frequency of phonon to be traveling through the plates to see if you could alter the coupling between the photons and the polarization field.
Well, I think you need a lot more to go on before you started thinking about this, because as far as I can tell, he doesn't really point you to somebody who's got this exact breed of polariton. There are lots of different kinds of polaritons, and some of them are sort of coupling photons to excitons and semiconductors. Some of them are coupling to surface plasmons, like in that three-slit experiment we talked about. Probably that had something to do with that. So you've got a lot of different breeds of polaritons. And on top of that, I don't think anybody would have calculated something in this particular situation where you need a little bit of polariton on either side. Probably. That's how I interpret the thing that you'd actually have to be creating. But once you have that, now you have a connection in this form between the two plates. Basically, if you have a little bit of a fluctuation, that fluctuation is between both of those plates. It's not just in this plate or that plate. It's not just creating little electric fields because of it. It's an excitation in both of those plates, and those things have some real coupling between them.
So is that like inducing like a parallel polarization between molecules in the different plates so they have like an electrical attraction to each other? Is that not?
I'm not completely sure, because I think, again, the reason why I went through all those differences is because I don't think anybody did it this way. I think he's really just pushing his toy model towards this sort of interpretation of a polariton, and not the particular interpretation I'm giving you. The interpretation of the modes that I'm giving you are my interpretation of what he's saying. So that's probably not what he's saying at all. I don't think anybody's calculated a polariton spectrum out of this kind of quasi-particle, where you've got a little bit of one material, a little bit of another material, plus part of that photon in the vacuum between.
Well, this is a 2017 paper. Maybe he'll continue and develop that.
Possibly. I don't think so. I don't think that's... I'm not sure, but I don't think that's really the sort of stuff that he does. I thought he was more of a high-energy physicist, but I'm not completely sure. So that's how I... what he's doing. I mean, that actually is the most sensible thing out of these two papers that I read. That's a real positive thought about what actually has to be going on in a quantum mechanical manner, because you need this to, in the long run, be quantum mechanical in nature. The toy model, while it's interesting, and it shows that to get a Casimir-like force, you don't need the vacuum fluctuations, right? You can have the fluctuations being the material. This toy model is less predictive of what really goes on than, say, Bohm was doing with his interpretation of quantum mechanics. Bohm's interpretation of quantum mechanics is more predictive than this is.
Yeah, because this is a really simple down version.
But it has the same intent that Bohm's did, which is, I'm showing you something. It may not be the right theory, but it fits things well. Again, this is part of the reason why I chose this over the other one, because at least this gives you a rationale why you should believe him, why you should take his point of view, and that I can produce this force with this toy model that is a Casimir-like force with the electric field-like thing, because instead of being two vectors, it's one scalar. But other than that, it's an electric field-like thing, or electromagnetic field-like thing. You get something rational out of it. So that's a nice little way to show how everything works out, but it is not, in my opinion, anywhere near showing this is the right way to think about it. I think Jaffe's paper is closer to showing that it's the right way to think about it, although I think this is a lot more concrete in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, they're both talking about van der Waals forces, except in this guy's case, this paper, he's reduced it to a very simple mathematical structure that really gets to the heart of how that van der Waals force manifests in the Casimir effect. So I think they arrived at kind of a similar place, but in different ways. Like, Jaffe seemed to stick with more conventional, complete treatment of QED. And it looks like in this, what was interesting about this paper is that he was really wanted to get to an explicit mechanism that wasn't mathematically imponderable. And I think he succeeded in that. I found it to be really compelling.
I mean, I think they've done a fairly good job. Again, after I read these, I went back and I spot checked a few things in the materials paper, and it seems really strong here. I know you're a big fan of quantum vacuum fluctuations, but I do really think we need to at some point go through and look at something where they're actually looking at this in terms of quantum vacuum fluctuations, since, you know, all we've done is look at people saying it's not.
Right. I guess it would be nice to get the other side of the argument.
Yeah, we want to see what somebody has to say positively about it, right? We want somebody to be showing us how to actually use it. Again, you know, we've got these two papers where they're showing us something positive, how you can use the Drude model to get some results, how you can use this toy model to get some results. You know, really, if we want to discuss the quantum vacuum, we ought to talk a little bit about how you can use the quantum vacuum to get these results.
That's true, but I think it would be interesting to look at the larger scope of how the physics community has applied the existence of the quantum vacuum fluctuations to other things like Hawking radiation and the UNRWA effect in the UNRWA radiation. Vacuum fluctuations appear in a lot of recent experimental efforts to create particle pairs with mirrors that are moving really quickly. I don't know if you've seen any of that stuff, but there's all these different regimes where the vacuum fluctuations seem to be an instrumental theoretical facet of what they're doing. I think there's more to the physics of vacuum fluctuations than the Casimir effect, and it might be interesting to see if we could do an overview of the things that have come out of that model and see how credible they are. I mean, we've never really seen Hawking radiation, but I think there's an analog with nonlinear optical crystals where they've seen Hawking radiation just in light effects.
We can look at a couple of those things. That would be a good idea. There we go. What do you think we've learned from all this, Randy? What have we learned?
Trust no one.
Trust no one. I thought you got that from X-Files.
I did.
Okay.
But I also felt it when we started looking into this question, because it was kind of surprised me. I mean, after years and years of reading about vacuum fluctuation and hearing all of my favorite brightest minds blowing my mind about how every cubic centimeter of space is roiling with this virtual energy, to suddenly, you know, see that there's an entirely different way of explaining the Casimir effect, which was really the only physical observable effect that seemed to be attributed to that. Suddenly that's being called into question. You really can't take anything for granted, even your most basic assumptions.
I think that's a pretty reasonable thing to take out of this. I think this is a pretty interesting way to look at things, and I think it's getting more and more interesting all the time. I would like to look at some of these other things. I think we should also continue occasionally popping back and seeing what these guys will have to say as well. If that's all you've got, that's all I've got.
Then let's say it's been got.
Okay, we got it all. Awesome.
We got it.
Okay, bye now, Randy.
Bye, Jim.